This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. President Joe Biden is again set to visit Wisconsin in coming days, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The president is slated to visit Racine County this Thursday when he's expected to tout an expansion of a data center run by Microsoft. That data center is in the village of Mount Pleasant, near the site of the Foxconn project that promised, but failed to deliver, 13,000 new jobs and was praised by former President Donald Trump in 2018. Microsoft has pledged a minimum value of $1 billion on the first phase of its development. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris is slated to head to Milwaukee next week on Thursday, May 16th. No details yet on where she's expected to speak. It'll be the fourth visit to Wisconsin this year for both the president and vice president. Wisconsin is one of just a few battleground states in the 2024 presidential election, with recent polling showing both Biden and Trump within the margin of error to win the state.
Today, the Republican-controlled Wisconsin legislature's budget committee approved the spending of $36 million to fight opioid abuse. It's the third round of funding dispersed as part of a massive settlement from opioid manufacturers and distributors for their role in amping up the opioid crisis. The Joint Finance Committee met to rework a proposal from the State Health Department on the best uses for this round of money to be spent in fiscal year 2025. Republican leadership on that committee changed recommendations from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Under the new spending plan, more than $9 million will go to law enforcement, more than $7 million will go to treatment programs, and more than $1 million will go toward education campaigns. Republican committee co-chairs also stood firm against a request from Democratic Governor Tony Evers to approve funding on another public health crisis, PFAS contamination. $125 million in state funding to help address the family of so-called forever chemicals is already planned in the current state budget. Republican lawmakers, though, have balked at releasing these funds to the Department of Natural Resources.
Republican state lawmakers have also launched an audit of diversity activities across state agencies, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Wisconsin legislature's Joint Audit Committee signed off on this plan today. The Legislative Audit Bureau will examine activities within the state's executive branch that relate to DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion. This audit comes after months of pushing from Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who pushed for the audit as far back as December. It also comes after the state legislature held up UW system funding for months over similar initiatives. The audit will look at the content and cost of DEI activities and report back to the legislature. The process is expected to last into 2025. A spokesperson for the governor called today's move purely ideological and politically driven.
The Dane County Executive's Office is under the first of multiple temporary leaders who will follow Joe Parisi's planned resignation last Friday. Supervisor Patrick Miles, former chair of the Dane County Board, has temporarily assumed the role, and later this month the board will vote to appoint another interim county executive. That person will serve until November when a special election for county executive will be on the ballot. This weekend marked the open season for candidates to begin circulating nomination papers for the position. At least four candidates have announced that they're running. To make it on the ballot, though, they'll need to collect 500 signatures by early next month.
The City of Madison Water Utility has released its annual water quality report for 2023. All 20 of the city's wells have again cleared all state and federal standards for drinking water, according to the report, which also details the trace elements and chemicals found in drinking water. Six wells, 11, 13, 14, 16, 25, and 29, had trace levels of atrazine, which is typically from a runoff from herbicides used on crops. Five wells had trace levels of PCE, which is typically discharged from factories, dry cleaners, and auto shops. As for the family of forever chemicals known as PFAS, well, the water utility tests twice a year for the 30 most common PFAS chemicals. At least one PFAS chemical was found in half of Madison's wells, though the city also meets all state groundwater standards for PFAS. This report is online at cityofmadison.com/news. The water utility also maintains an online tool for determining the drinking well at your address and its quality of water.
The City of Madison isn't the only local government mulling over an upcoming referendum to fund services. The Madison Metropolitan School District is too. A tour of Vell Phillips Memorial High School tonight will show off recent upgrades to that and Madison's other high schools, upgrades that voters approved in a 2020 referendum. The series of tours continues this Thursday at 6 p.m. with a tour of West High School. Tours of La Follette and East High School will follow the next two Tuesdays at the same time. The tours come as the district says its middle schools are in need of similar upgrades, even as those needs extend beyond what it says can be budgeted for as a regular operating cost.
The Madison City Council is slated to take up a resolution tonight in support of UW-Madison students protesting the war in Gaza. The resolution, co-sponsored by five alders, calls for UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin to authorize the encampment, termed the Popular University for Gaza, so long as students are exercising their First Amendment rights. It also calls on the Chancellor and UW-Madison administration to discontinue any disciplinary action against students and faculty for participating in the protest. Lastly, the resolution directs Madison Police Chief Sean Barnes to clarify operating procedures for the MPD and how it responds to demonstrations. That comes as several police agencies, including the Dane County Sheriff's Office and Madison Police Department, joined UW-Madison police in a raid on the encampment last Wednesday with the stated goal of removing camping equipment. This resolution has received hundreds of pages of public comment already. Also at tonight's meeting, the City Council is expected to get a presentation on housing market initiatives, create a historic marker program for up to 6 new historic markers this year, and recognize May 10th as Provider Appreciation Day. The meeting starts at 6:30 p.m. and can be streamed online. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
The city of Madison is facing a $27 million budget deficit for 2025. To prepare for the difficult conversations and decisions ahead, the city is holding a series of budget engagement events where the public can learn more, ask questions, and provide feedback on what city services are important to them. WRT contributor Christina Leffring attended the first event last Wednesday.
The cafeteria at Kennedy Elementary School on Madison's east side is packed. It's the first in a series of budget engagement events the city is holding on the 2025 budget, where the city faces a $27 million shortfall.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for coming this evening.
Finance Director Dave Schmeidike opens with a quick 20-minute presentation on the budget. And at each table, there are packets with more information. Then everyone gets to take a break, grab some food, and write questions for Schmeidike to answer. And people have lots of questions.
How are the general operations for each department determined each year? Why can't the city add a city sales tax? Can we add an additional room tax for hotels, Airbnb rentals, etc.? What is the amount of the rainy day fund? Is there a draft budget plan to close the budget gap using only service cuts, or are the only plans to raise taxes via referendum or use new special charges?
That's a great question. Thank you. What we've been trying to do...
I thought there were some really great questions this evening, really trying to understand the city budget.
That's Schmeidike talking with WORT after the event.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, a greater challenge than we've seen in previous budgets. So I think this conversation is really important.
After the Q&A, people broke out into small groups to provide feedback. Lots of feedback.
Because of climate change, leaves are falling later in the year. So we're spending money on trucks and people and fuel and maintenance for that. And they're driving around not collecting anything because I got leaf pickup and my leaves haven't fallen yet.
If this county can levy a sales tax, have them levy a sales tax and get them to pay us for some service that we...
That's a good point, because we have a lot of people who commute into Madison for jobs and other things, and they end up using some of our services as well.
Green space and the lakes and all of that contribute to just, I think, a beautiful city that we live in.
That's what I was just going to say, was all the parks and the water, and they're so close to everything. Like, you're in a big city, but yet, you know, to have them just a block or two away... to be able to be on the water is amazing.
That's not for discussion here, but I'm wondering why Metro can't figure out how to support itself.
I mean, I would imagine that one way would be to increase fares, and that wouldn't be equitable.
That's Alder Figueroa Cole. Each table had either an alder or a city staff member facilitating the discussion, taking notes, and, when possible, answering questions.
I do live on the Far East Side, and the bus service for me is zilch.
I totally understand that. I understand what you mean. It feels like we try to remove something from here, and then we impact something over here. And it's just like how to balance those priorities is what we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, Kelly was talking about the affordability, how much it costs to live in Madison, saying that it's getting quite expensive.
That's Sam Munger, chief of staff for the mayor's office, summarizing what members of his group said while he writes it down.
And he hopes that that trend doesn't continue or maybe reverses. And Amy was saying that it can really hollow out the middle class, really hollow out the middle.
At Munger's table, several members said they would like breakdowns of how the city spends its budget presented to residents more often, not just when the city is facing a crisis.
Plan B.
The other thing I would say is just be more transparent about the cost overall of the city. I mean, honestly, I realize that most people wouldn't want this, but I would just, wow, man, I should be able to see much more of what it costs to run this city than I do today. I don't know if I need every financial transaction, but we should just have much more fiscal transparency.
At the end of the night, facilitators read off some of the big takeaways from their group discussions. It's probably no surprise that a lot of people said they don't want to see cuts in services and appreciate city services such as parks and libraries. But the state hasn't given the city much wiggle room. On one hand, Madison got one of the lowest rates of shared revenue of any municipality. And on the other, the Republican state legislature limits local government's options for raising money. And as one resident at Munger's table said, the city needs to come up with long-term solutions.
As much as I don't want any of this to go away, I do want just like the fiscal responsibility question to be before us. So, and it goes back to that, like, not just punting towards the future, but okay, we can sober-mindedly make hard decisions today for the future.
The city has scheduled 4 more budget engagement events so far. For the West Side on May 16th, for the South Side and Near West Side on May 29th, for the Downtown, Isthmus, and Campus region on May 30th, and for the North Side on June 5th. More details and registration are available on the city's website on the Common Council's page. City officials hosted a budget engagement session on WORT's midday talk show, which is available at WORTFM.org. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Christina Leffring.
This afternoon, dozens of Indigenous community members and their supporters gathered on the steps of the Wisconsin State Capitol for the 3rd annual Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. Survivors and relatives of victims addressed the group, and others led chants and singing. Though rain forced the event inside the Capitol, the group made good on their promise to wrap the Capitol in red as a huge human chain encircled the lower floor of the rotunda. WRT reporter Jess Miller spoke to Rachel Fernandez, who helped organize the event.
And we're here to bring light to our families that have missing and murdered loved ones, to survivors, and to remind people of the power that we have to change things, to decolonize. I wanted to bring everybody together to center the families and survivors' voices, because those are the voices that we need at these tables to make change. And all the systems that are in place for us, all these organizations, the government, they need to consult with families first. Fellow advocates, we're always advocating for families, nothing about us without us, to bring that part of that healing that is needed in their stories, because sometimes, well, most of the time, they don't get to tell their stories. We are ignored in media, in the news, and it's important that we let others know what is happening to us. And this is the genocide that's been happening to us since colonization. And we have the power. We have the power. We have to take back that power for those that feel like they don't have that anymore. We have that power to make impactful change. Some of the stories that were shared was domestic violence, sexual assault, trafficking, the child welfare system, substance abuse, substance use. There's so many intersections that are happening that lead to our relatives being missing and murdered. That has to stop. And it starts with us. Legislation needs to change. We need to make more laws that will impact us in ending this gender-based violence.
Could you talk a little bit about how you got involved in this work?
I'm a survivor. In my late 20s, I went missing. I was trafficked. Nobody knew. Everybody thought that I was just out partying, which I was, but it was normal. And what was happening to me was some atrocities, very bad violence. And that stemmed from child sexual assault. And that led me to many other things, the intersections. I tried to take my own life, domestic violence, rape, trafficking. I had an eating disorder. I went through everything. I lost a child. So all of these traumas impacted the choices that I made. I do not want to take away that the people that perpetrated this violence against me, I do not want to take away from that because they have to own that. But had I had the healthy choices, had I had the teachings, the cultural connection, all of that, I don't think I would have went through most of what I went through. So through my healing is what brought me here, is into advocacy. And I feel like it's my life's work, it's my passion, because I am one of them. And I'm fortunate to be here. I know that. I'm thankful to Creator for being here yet, so that I can teach my children and my grandchildren that they don't have to go through this. And there are things that they can do to cope with things that are happening in their lives. Because we all know that things will happen, but I want to change that. I want to break the cycles. And I don't want anybody to go through what I went through.
Did this happen in Wisconsin, or how did you end up in Wisconsin?
No, I'm from the Menominee Reservation. I moved away to Green Bay for a few years, and that's when it happened. And at that time, there was domestic violence. I was drinking, I was using. It was just like this domino effect, and I didn't give a crap about myself, my well-being. I just drowned myself and numbed myself. So that led me to being taken, and I was states away, and I fought my way back. And so I'm here to give testimony to that things don't have to be like that, and things can change, and we can empower others to make those changes too.
Can you tell me a little bit about this branch here that's in your pocket?
Oh, cedar? It's one of our medicines. So what we did is we were able to gather medicines. We have the tobacco, sage, sweetgrass, and cedar, and we provided that for everybody that attended. It's medicines to help you with your spirit. So we use this for smudging, we use this for teas. You know, there's different uses for our medicines, but it's for protection too, so.
I know you talked a little bit about legislation. What can listeners do to help to get involved?
I believe that if people want to be allies, if people want change, they can talk to our representatives here at the Capitol. Anybody in government, we can approach them and ask them, what are you going to do about this? You know, we would like to see this. You know, we advocate for ourselves in that way, and that's how we, you know, make effective change. And hopefully somebody hears us and knows that this is wrong. You know, all this genocide, everything that's happening to us is wrong. And they put forth legislation for our safety, our protection, and the funding. We're always struggling on reservations with, law enforcement not being paid, or the lack of law enforcement because we don't have enough funding to get them. So I think that's a big part of that. You know, they're overworked. and we don't have enough staff. So I think with people advocating, if we have those allies that are in positions that can advocate effectively for us, this is why we share our stories. This is why we say the names. This is why we tell people what happened so that they know, because a lot of people don't know, because we're not in the news. We're not in the media. We're not anywhere. We're doing that ourselves, and that's mostly on social media. We're coming together. We're doing the searches. We're doing everything with response that law enforcement lacks and the media lacks. We jump right in and do what we need to for our relatives. But that should be coming from everybody.
Time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us.
On this week's edition of Stuff Your Face, feature contributor Emily Tucker sits down with Bunyamin Irk, who is owner of and chef at the Mediterranean Joint on Williamson Street. Bunyamin and his brother Ender opened the Mediterranean Joint last summer and have hit their stride, offering up a variety of dishes from the Mediterranean region, including their home of Turkey. Emily and Bunyamin discuss the journey to opening his first restaurant, joys and challenges of the food industry, and the importance of supporting local food to create community.
My name is Emily Tucker, and this is Stuff Your Face. I'm here for our third edition of the show with Bunyamin Irk at the Mediterranean Joint on Williamson Street. Bunyamin is the chef and owner here at the Mediterranean Joint and goes by Benji. Benji, thanks so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. I'm very happy to be here with you. I'm so excited.
Thank you. So I got a tip from a fellow WORT employee to come here and check you guys out. I brought my husband and our four-year-old a few weeks ago, and we really loved the experience. I understand you and your brother started the restaurant together and are of Turkish descent. So tell me, when did you open the restaurant and what was the journey like to get here?
So it was our first restaurant. It was me and my little brother. We both graduated from gastronomy high school and gastronomy college, like a culinary art. And then he was keep pushing me to open a place, and I was okay, it's not a time, but like okay. And then he finally find this cute space on Village Street, and then I said okay, we'll do it. And then we opened July 1st last year. It was 2023. It took us almost 4 months to get everything ready because it was our first baby. We were excited and we done it.
Well, congratulations. It's really a wonderful place. When we came, we ordered basically a table's worth of food, which is just the way my husband and I like to roll. And the food came out so quickly, so fresh. And I really want to say that the quality of the food was matched by the quality of the service. You know, we ordered here at the counter, but a table was cleared for us right away. You all offered us a high chair. You even gave us a complimentary baklava at the end. These days, when you go out to eat and you have that experience, it really feels like a dream. So I'm curious, how have you found the sweet spot of having both counter service and a really inviting dining in experience as well?
When we opened, we had very hard time finding employees, and then we weren't sure how to start, and we were super excited. Before even we turn our lights open sign, people were keep walking in and they were excited to see us. And then we start taking their orders on the counter service, and we watch, and they seem like they really liked it because, you know, with server there's a benefit, and then, you know, people not really want to wait too long for their bill. But on this time, you just come order, pick, we'll bring the food whenever it's ready. It will be very fast, and we like this spot, and it worked out.
You really have found a great balance there. So I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, so I've been a longtime fan of Mediterranean Cafe that's on State Street. What do you think sets you apart from other Mediterranean restaurants in Madison?
When we were in the high school in culinary arts, we had to do internships. So my little brother went to Greece and he worked little coffee shop and he learned a lot of Greek food. And then as we're Turkish, so we also wanted to put everything together, all our experience. And then when I was at Chef UW-Madison, I was also cooking with a lot of younger students. And then they were also pushing us, hey, Chef, you got to open some Mediterranean restaurant. Anytime, you know, I was cooking some Mediterranean dishes, they really enjoyed it and thought I was a little different. My recipes from my grandma, grandpa, you know, they helped me a lot when we opened this place. So that's the difference, I think.
I love to hear that you use recipes from your grandparents. Family history is really important to me, and I think that that's so special in cooking and baking. We can pass on our family traditions, and you're sharing them with all of us in Madison, which is wonderful. I'm still thinking about the stuffed grape leaves and the lentil soup that we had here a few weeks ago, and I'm even looking up at the menu to see what I want to take home to my family this evening. So I'm curious, what is your favorite thing to stuff your face with on your menu?
Well, my favorite dish is chicken shawarma. There is a little backstory on that dish because we're Turkish. We haven't had any good chicken shawarma because it's a Lebanese food. And then we had a very good customer. He was Lebanese and he gave us a lot of good idea. And I really enjoy because we marinate for 24 hours now. And then we char grill and it's always tender, always juicy. And last year in 6 months, we sold almost 17,000 chicken shawarma plates. That was crazy.
Wow, that is fantastic. And I think that's what my husband ordered when we came. So, Benji, what is your favorite thing about working in the food industry?
A lot of favorite things, because when you are owner, you also do everything here while you're here. And then I wake up at 6 a.m. My wife wakes me up. I have a 2-year-old daughter. And then, you know, I start day with them. And then I go Restaurant Depot, shop my food items, come here, prep everything, get ready for lunch. You know, it's a lot of fun, a lot of fast pace. So I love working with food industry.
Everyone who works here seems really excited and happy. So you mentioned that you go to the, you know, Restaurant Depot in the morning and get your food for the day. Are you able to source any local ingredients? I know you had, you know, a variety of fresh vegetables.
On summertime, we have the farmer's market. We like to go and shop. We go buy heirloom tomatoes, fresh basil, fresh mint as much as possible. We bought a nice fresh curds from the farmer's market, and then we turned them to Mediterranean cheese curds because people were dying for it. And yeah, we like to get things from Lake Mills, Wisconsin. We get our feta cheese from them. We like to buy everything from local people too.
Well, I am definitely one of those people that is dying for Mediterranean cheese curds. So thank you. And that's really exciting that you're able to shop the Dane County Farmers Market when you can. If there is anything you could tell the food world of Madison, what would you like to tell them?
First, I'll say just support your local small restaurant. It's super important. If you support them, they will be happy because you're just next door to them and they live with you. And you know, if we're happy, you're happy. That makes our neighbor very happy, and just support your local business.
That's what makes the world go round, right? And I certainly felt that eating here, that this is a place for the community and the food is so good. So thank you, Benji. And thank you to your brother also and everyone who works here. And as I'm sitting here, I just was presented with a beautiful piece of baklava and a little cup of tea. So it's just further exemplifying how wonderful this place is. Thank you so much. And thank you for taking time out of your busy day to talk with me.
Thank you so much, Emily. It's great to meeting you. It's super excited. Thank you so much.
Trapping and releasing nuisance animals has its challenges, and there are guidelines in place to make sure that folks do it properly. But things only get more complicated during baby season. On tonight's Wildlife Weekly, Jackie Sandberg shares advice about how to handle tricky situations.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I want to give an update about the mammal species we've been admitting to our center, and also talk a little bit about trapping and relocating wildlife, because it's been a common theme here over the last few weeks where a lot of people in the Dane County area and just all over southern Wisconsin have found themselves in situations where maybe unintentionally or intentionally, they've moved a wild animal and then had a couple of things go wrong where the repercussions end up kind of extreme, meaning orphaning babies. So it is the time of year where mammals are having their babies, birds are having their babies too, but I want to specifically talk about mammal babies this week because our phone call volume is very, very high regarding eastern cottontail rabbits and eastern gray squirrels, raccoons, all the species that are definitely early nesters here in our state. So sometimes that's going to be in March, April, May, and we usually have an influx in the early summer and then a second peak in the fall. So this is pretty applicable for the rest of the year here. But the tricky part is that if you've got some situation where you know you have an adult mammal, and maybe they are somewhere near your home, they've denned in a tree in your backyard, something, you know, very close to your house where you're worried about damage, we understand the intention that people might have to try to exclude those animals, and there are really good ways to do that. Typically, we would recommend humane exclusion practices where we try to encourage the animal to leave on their own rather than trapping and relocating them. A few things you might need to know is that trapping and relocating in Wisconsin does truly require a trapper's license. It is something you would have to get through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. However, if you are a homeowner and you own the property that you are trapping at, there are some legal guidelines you can use to be able to move those animals potentially, which include being able to put out a live trap, for example, for a nuisance animal. Now, typically, I don't like to call them nuisance animals, but it is something that we use as a term to help describe a situation where someone doesn't want an animal on their property or near their property, because we usually encourage tolerance and trying to coexist with the animals that live in our area. However, the situations where someone might put out a live trap because it would be legal in that situation, let's say, just as we had a couple of days ago, someone live trapped an adult raccoon. The raccoon was taken multiple miles away to a release site that was a permission, you know, something granted by someone else. That's another part of the legal process. You do have to have permission to release that animal on a property. So you can't just go out to a county park or to a state park or just some open field somewhere and just drop off an animal. That's not going to be good for the animal, nor is it going to be good for friendly neighbor feels, if especially if someone maybe sees you doing it. So not really highly recommended for either option, but when you relocate an animal like that, you are taking them away from their home site, their den, their territory, spots where they know their food is. And, you know, just like you know your area, if you're driving around or you're walking around, you know what streets to go on. You know how to walk home. You know where the ins and outs and the places that you're passing. You know, as a human, you're probably not as aware of potential dangers, but you're able to look and see, oh, is this normal? Is this not normal? That's what another animal would see. And we are mammals, right? So, you know, a raccoon is going to be able to know where she finds food, where she's able to safely walk to get back, the fastest way, the fastest route. But also, there are babies during this time of year. So in this particular situation, a raccoon being translocated multiple miles away, depending on how far away it was, because we don't really know the circumstances there, a week later, baby raccoons started coming out underneath the spot where she had been denning. And then five more little emaciated baby raccoons were trapped with adorable eyes, and, you know, they were just so sad. And, you know, it's one of the species we don't actually work with at the Humane Society, but in this particular situation, again, the finder didn't know what to do and just arrived at the Humane Society with them. And it's always great for us to get a call ahead. We do schedule appointments at our wildlife clinic, so it can kind of help us to ease the flow of the day, because we can get hundreds of calls and lots of animals admitted. And having an unexpected couple of, you know, baby mammals like raccoons that we aren't actually licensed to work with can be a huge challenge. So I just want to give a big shout out to those that are in the area that do work with raccoons. It's just one of the species that are incredibly difficult, very specialized, and take so much care all the way into the fall season. So these little ones were very luckily transferred to a facility that has permits to work with them in our area, but it really puts a ton of burden on the wildlife rehabilitation community by having so many of those come in unexpectedly, and also from a situation that could be preventable, where if we had excluded the mom and then potentially kept her with her babies, in this situation the babies had their eyes open, they would have crawled towards mom because mom is going to vocalize to them even if she wasn't a live trap. And hopefully there are better ways to be able to seal off the entrances or exits to the den, even if it was just temporarily, so that she could move her babies one by one to another nest site. Because raccoons do that, squirrels also do that. We've had multiple cases of squirrels coming down from trees that have been cut down and their nests have been inside recently. And again, this one's another situation where, although sometimes people will put those babies out for mom to take, we had a call a couple of days ago that was, you know, about 100 feet maybe from the original tree nest. So if you take down a tree, but then you put the babies maybe even 50 feet away, but certainly 100 feet away, not probably close enough for mom to be able to find those babies. She's going to be frantic looking for them at the exact same spot. Our recommendation is to put those babies right back on the stump of the tree and keep them warm. Check out our website for reuniting details and information if you need any guidance, or give us a call, because reuniting with them with their parents really truly does work if their nest site has been disturbed or there's been exclusion, anything like that. So those are two big situations we've had with different mammals that are easy to relocate. Rabbits are less easy to relocate because mom really truly needs to go right back where she put them in her nest, but it can at least be done where they can be protected from predators temporarily if something got into the nest, like your dog or your cat. Just have to monitor the situation, and hopefully the babies that are remaining in the nest or that can be gathered back into the nest material, if there are ways to hopefully keep mom coming back until they're about 4 weeks old and independent. Luckily, their turnaround is quite short, so don't be alarmed if you do find baby rabbits in a nest, but do know that there are successful ways to keep them in that location, at least through the time period where they're able to hop around, ears are up, eyes are open, they're eating greens and lots of dandelions in your yard, and then hopefully they can be kind of shooed towards other yards and they will disperse naturally and generally in pretty far distances. They won't stay in groups very long. And those are some general mammals that we're getting calls about right now and what they're doing. So thanks for listening today here on WORT. We've been talking about baby mammals, specifically some raccoons, squirrels, and rabbits, thinking about renesting and relocating. Preferably, we would choose humane exclusion in those situations and otherwise leave the babies where they are for now, at least until they can go on their way and don't need the support of mom, because otherwise rehabilitators get overwhelmed with the hundreds and hundreds of animals that are out there that need help, which is unintentionally created by humans, unfortunately. So no orphaning situations would be the best. If you need any assistance or you have any questions about wildlife, give us a call at 608-287-3235. Otherwise, thanks for listening. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
As we learned earlier in tonight's show, city officials are hosting a series of community engagement meetings to explain Madison's budget woes. Don't have time to attend? Have no fear. City Finance Director Dave Schmidtke gave Douglas Haynes the bird's eye view on yesterday's A Public Affair. Visit our website at WORTFM.org to hear the rest of their conversation, including input from city officials.
David, I've been told you are the expert on this topic as finance director for the city of Madison. So we're going to start with you for the details about the budget deficit in particular and what the causes of this deficit are as well.
Just to give you a little bit of background on the city budget, for the current year we're in, 2024, it's a little over $400 million. And that's in what we call our general fund, which supports the activities that residents really see every day, the refuse and recycling pickup, the snow plowing, our law enforcement and emergency medical services, our libraries, our parks, and so on. When we look ahead to next year and compare how much our revenues are allowed to grow under state law with our cost to continue those current services at current levels, the gap right now is estimated at about $27 million. There's a number of reasons for how we've gotten here. A lot of it is the structure of how Wisconsin and state law finances or allows cities to finance their services. Combine that with the economic impacts of the COVID pandemic and how, the way that the city's revenues to finance its services are really not connected so much to the economy, like, say, a sales tax or an income tax is, which both the state and the county, for example, county has a sales tax, the city does not. And both the city and the county saw large increases in revenues, you know, as people started buying things after the pandemic. We don't have that. And so that's a part of it. And we were able to keep services going through the pandemic because of the American Rescue Plan Act, the federal legislation that delivered really historic levels of support to local governments and states throughout our country. Madison received about $47 million from that. About half of that was put into sort of one-time supports for community services. So homelessness, youth employment, violence prevention, programs like that. And then the other half was kept to help maintain current service levels, which was another part of the federal legislation. And when we look at like what our revenues would have been prior to the pandemic compared to what actually happened, we're still about 5 to 10% below. If you look at the state and the county, they're well above. And so that gives you a sense of how state law kind of affects our ability to have the revenues to support the services of really the fastest growing city in Wisconsin.
David, I think it's worth going into a little bit more detail about two of the issues you just mentioned there. I'm going to start with one that's more general, which is on the surface, at least by some measures, one would see Madison as the most prosperous city in the state of Wisconsin, right? Mm-hmm. So one might ask, how could this happen in the most prosperous city that we would have this kind of major budget shortfall? And you were talking just now about differences in revenues that the state and the county enjoy and what mm-hmm. the city enjoys. So tell us a little bit more about why that prosperity doesn't translate to city government exactly.
Thanks for that question. That's a great question. It's really at the core of what's going on here. So the cities in Wisconsin, Madison's not any different than any other city for the most part, other than Milwaukee, are heavily reliant on the property tax. We have the highest reliance on property tax in the Midwest and probably the highest, among the highest in the country. And that's a design of state law that the local services are funded by the property tax. And then how Wisconsin does it is they have a system of where they're supposed to share revenues, income and sales taxes collected at the state level, shared with local governments. That has not been the case for over 20 years until the most recent state budget, where there was a significant increase. What Madison has seen as reductions in shared revenue disproportionately sort of allocated to Madison. And then in this most recent large increase in shared revenue, Madison got the lowest amount per capita. And that was a design of the legislature. They set it up that way. And that's the situation we're in. So when you look at the amount of state aid per capita, Madison gets $29 per person, per resident. The average statewide is $142. So you can see the disparity there. Like I said, we just don't have the breadth of revenues that other cities around the country have. We don't have a local sales tax. We don't have a local income tax that other places often have, or even, say, regional transit authorities have in other states. We don't have that here. So we have to use the property tax to help support a transit system, for example. So that's a big element of why we're here. The other is the state really controls growth in property taxes. So while we're getting a lot of people moving to Madison, we're getting, you know, appreciation in property values and things like that, our taxes can only go up by this formula that's tied to the value of new construction in the city. And that growth rate over the last few years in particular has been well below inflation. And then well below inflation and population growth.
So the city is sort of squeezed in multiple ways, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
So you just mentioned there that we have a few options, potentially local sales tax, transit fees, the property tax increase potentially. Tell us a little bit more about those.
Well, you mentioned sales and income tax. We don't have that option.
Yep.
So
it's not an option.
No, okay. The only way that Madison could do that is if the state legislature passed a law allowing Madison to do it. So we're not allowed to do it under current state law. And then the property tax, as I said, is limited under this formula, with the only option to increase it above that amount is a voter referendum. So that's our option on the property tax side. We do have other revenue sources, but they're very limited. So when you look at all of the revenue streams to the city budget, nearly 3/4 comes from the property tax. A little over 10% comes from the state in the form of state aid. And the remaining roughly 20% is what we call like fees, special charges, like when you get a building permit or if you need to have an ambulance take you to the hospital. We have fees for those sorts of things, but it's only about 20% of the budget. And the fees can't exceed the cost of actually providing the service. So it's not like a tax in the sense that it can cover other activities. So that's the revenue side. We also have the ability to do what are called special charges. We've done a couple of those over the last decade, one for urban forestry, and you'll see this on your water bill. There's a listing like stormwater and things like that. Urban forestry is one example. Another is the resource recovery special charge related to recycling pickup. But even the state limits some of those as well in terms of how much you can do with that. The other side of it is looking at expenditures. And when we look at expenditures, that's really about the level of services that residents can expect to receive.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WRT's Live Local News at 6. Jess Miller and Christina Leffring were your reporters this evening.
Special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg, Emily Tucker, and a public affair host, Douglas Haynes.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Bay Parks produced this newscast.
And Shelley Pittman is the news director at WRT and wrote tonight's headlines. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WRT Local News podcast and subscribe wherever you get your pods.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Up next is Spanish language news with the Nuestro Patio. Good night.